अजरं पाशम् आत्मनक्खवयो विरुः स एव सारुषुकृतो मोक्षद्वारम् अपावृतम् Attachment.
Attachment.
Ajara.
Ajara.
Strong.
Strong.
Pasham.
Pasham.
Entanglement.
Entanglement.
Atmanah.
Atmanah.
The soul.
Kovayaha,
learned men. Viruhu,
Viruhu.
No.
No.
Sa-eva.
Sa-eva.
That same.
That same.
Sarushu.
Sarushu.
To the devotees.
To the devotees.
Ritaha,
Ritaha,
applied,
applied,
moksha dwara,
moksha dwara,
the door of liberation,
the door of liberation,
apavritam,
apavritam,
opened,
opened,
translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Every learned man knows very well that attachment for the material is the greatest entanglement of the spirit soul. But that same attachment, when applied to the self-realized devotees, opens the door of liberation. Purport. Here it is clearly stated that attachment for one thing is the cause of bondage in conditional life. And the same attachment, when applied to something else, opens the door of liberation. Attachment cannot be killed. It has simply to be transferred. Attachment for material things is called material consciousness. An attachment for Krishna or His devotee is called Krishna consciousness. Consciousness, therefore, is the platform of attachment. It is clearly stated here that when we simply purify the consciousness from material consciousness to Krishna consciousness, we attain liberation. Despite the statement that one should give up attachment, desirelessness is not possible for a living entity. There's no one here. A living entity, by constitution, has the propensity to be attached to something. Thank you. We see that if someone has no object of attachment, if he has no children, then he transfers his attachment to cats and dogs. This indicates that the propensity for attachment cannot be stopped. It must be utilized for the best purpose. Our attachment for material things perpetuates our conditional state. But the same attachment, when transferred to the Supreme Personality of Godhead or His devotee, is the source of liberation. One second. Here is recommended that attachment should be transferred to the self-realized devotees, the sadhus. And who is a sadhu? A sadhu is not just an ordinary man with a saffron robe or a long beard. A sadhu is described in Bhagavad Gita as one who unflinchingly engages in devotional service. Sorry. Okay. Even though one is found not to be following the strict rules and regulations of devotional service, if one simply has unflinching faith in Krishna, the personality of Godhead,
he is understood to be a sadhu.
Sadhurdeva samantavyaha. A sadhu is a strict follower of devotional service. It is recommended here that if one at all wants to realize Brahman or spiritual perfection, his attachment should be transferred to the sadhu or devotee. Lord Chaitanya also confirms this. Lobo matra sadhu sange sarva siddhi hoy. Simply by a moment's association with a sadhu, one can attain perfection. Mahatma is a synonym of sadhu. It is said that service to a Mahatma, or elevated devotee of the Lord, is dwaram ahur vimukte, the royal road of liberation. Mahat Sri Ram, dwaram ahur vimuktes, tamo dwaram yoshitam samvisandam. This is from the beginning of Lord Rishabhdev's instructions to his 100 sons. I'll translate it. The service to the great devotees is the door to liberation, and the association of those who associate too much with women is the door to darkness. Basically, what it says. Rendering service, Prabhupada says, rendering service to the materialists has the opposite effect. If anyone offers service to a gross materialist or a person engaged in sense gratification, then by association with such a person, the door to hell is opened. The same principle is confirmed here. Attachment to a devotee is attachment to the service of the Lord. Because if one associates with a sadhu, the result will be that the sadhu will teach him how to become a devotee, a worshipper and a sincere servitor of the Lord. These are the gifts of a sadhu. If we want to associate with a sadhu, we cannot expect him to give us instructions on how to improve our material condition. But he will give us instructions on how to cut the knot of the contamination of material attraction and how to elevate ourselves in devotional service. That is the result of associating with a sadhu. Kapila Muni first of all instructs that the path of liberation begins with such association. Here, Lord Kapila is making it clear that his idea of what is a sadhu and what is the business of a sadhu is totally different than the ideas of the impersonalists. He doesn't have an impersonalist conception of a sadhu. Because, as is evident from the way he's talking, we should give up all material attachment, but we should be attached to devotees. We should be attached to the Supreme Lord. And because the devotees are the representatives of the Supreme Lord, they are the ones who can help us get in touch with the Supreme Lord, because they have that contact. So we can network with Krishna by contacting his devotees. The idea is, become attached to the devotees. Then you will become successful in detaching yourself from everything material. That's not an impersonal concept. The impersonalists want to detach themselves from everything. This Advaitavada is a non-relational philosophy. In other words, they don't believe in relationships. We believe in relationships, that we have a relational concept of spiritual life. We want to have our eternal relationship with Krishna. They want to dissolve. They want to merge. They want a unary function with no two... Hare Krishna. No two separate entities. They want just everything is one. But when everything is one, when there's only one, there cannot be any relationship. We may think that having relationships is bad, only because the relationships we've had in our life have been bad. You know, we had bad experience with our former spouse, our current spouse, our girlfriend, our friends, our co-workers, our employees, our teachers, the government, everybody else we know. We have bad experiences with relationships. So we think relationship is bad. This is the psychology of the Mayavadis, of the Advaitavadis, is that they want to avoid. They've had enough relationships in material life. They want a spiritual life with no relationships. So let's all merge into one. We'll all become God, infinite, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent everywhere. No difference between you and me or anybody else. We're all the same. And we don't have to worry about any more relationships. No more anxiety, frustration, hassles from relationships. That's the psychological basis. But it's not rational. It's not a realistic idea of spiritual life. Krishna, I'm sorry, says in the Gita, Natvaham jatu nasam natvam neme janadibaha natvaiva nabhavishyamaho sarveva yamas atakparam. There wasn't ever a time when I, your friend Krishna, did not exist as Krishna. And I've always been your friend. This relationship we have, a friendship, I heard you were visiting, is eternal. Arjuna is Krishna's eternal friend. There never was a time, Krishna reminds Arjuna, when I wasn't there as your friend, Krishna. Maybe in a different form, maybe we were somebody else in a previous life, different roles, different names, but we were always the same friends. And I have a relationship with everybody on this battlefield, even my enemies. They're all my eternal devotees, although some of them have forgotten it. So sarvevayam atakparam natvam nebi janadipaha. Never was there a time when I did not exist as a separate individual, or you, Arjuna, or all these kings on the battlefield, or anybody anywhere in the universe. All living entities are eternal. Nachaiva nabhavishyamaha. And there's no time in the future where any of us will stop to be individuals. Mayavadis say, yes, we're eternal, but we're not eternally separate individual people. You know, there's a time when we will merge into the impersonal supreme and stop being separate persons. Krishna denies that. All of us, sarve vayam, that's first person plural. Why first person? Because when the person who's talking includes himself, then you have to use the first person. When you're not talking about yourself, you're saying you're talking to the person. The person who you're talking to, you're talking about him. You know, excuse me. There's a bug on your shoulder. You have a bug on your shoulder. That's second person. And third person is, why is he laughing at us over there? There's somebody else, other than the person who's talking. And the person he's talking to, that's the third person, anybody else. But what if there's many people in the room, I'm talking to you, everyone else is just listening, and I say, all of us are eternal. That means everybody in the room. You use the first person when you include yourself, even if you also include the person who's speaking to, you're speaking to, and anybody else. If you're including yourself, then it's first person. We. Everybody here, including myself. You know, that includes you, I'm talking to you. That includes even those who I'm not talking to, who happen to be here. It's all we, all first person. That's grammar. First person plural means including everybody. Everybody who's, who's present is included when you say we. And you're talking about separate individuals. If there's only one person, you're not supposed to use the plural. You're supposed to use the singular. Aham, not vayam. So, Krishna says, all of us in the future, and he specified who's all of us, me, Krishna, you, Arjuna, and all the kings on the battlefield. All of us. There is no time in the future when we will cease to be. We, plural, separate individuals. Not that in a point of time when gradually, one after another, the living entities will merge into me and we'll all become one. When the last living entity gets liberation, then we'll just be one. no more relationships. Krishna's not saying that. Sarve Vayam, all of us, plurality of individuals. There's never a time when we stop being like that. Otherwise he'd say there's never a time when I would cease to be. Singular, but he's saying plural. The plurality will never stop to be. So the impersonalism is an erroneous idea. At least it doesn't agree with what Krishna thinks. If you want to deny the basic teaching of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, if you want to, you know, stop Krishna, and verse number 12 of the second chapter, when he just started to talk, he hasn't been speaking for more than 1 minute, if you want to raise your hand and say, excuse me, sir, I can't agree with what you say, go ahead. But, you know, then you have to make up some other philosophy. You've rejected Krishna's philosophy. Yeah, then you speak your own Gita then. Because you rejected Krishna even before he had a chance to start speaking. The beginning of his statement is that we all are eternal individuals. If you want to make up a different philosophy, no, we all merge into one. You know, at least I'm an emergent to one. You can remain an individual, but I'm an emergent to one, and I'll get my bliss that way. Go ahead and try. You can't do it. You can't do it. It's irrational. It's impractical. Impossible. And not only that, the psychology behind it is perverse. It's a sick cut psychology. Why should you want to do it, even if you could? Even if you could become God, why do you want to become God? Just because you have a bad experience of relationships, therefore you want to obliterate all relationships. And you want to do it by becoming God. What do you want to be God for? God has all the headaches. He's responsible for everything. If anything goes wrong in the universe, you can blame it on God. Yeah, and you want to be God. What for? And you want to be all by yourself. Try it. Test it first. Sit in a room by yourself. You know, turn off your mobile phone. Unplug the other phone. Shut the windows. Lock the door. And don't let anybody inside. And then sit there by yourself. Try it for 3 days. See how you like it. Be all by yourself and have no relationship with anybody. It's unnatural. And it will drive you crazy within 72 hours. You know, psychologists have tested, you know, people cannot last more than about 3 days in complete seclusion. You know, no sensation. Lights are out, nothing on. You don't feel anything. Nobody's there. Nobody talks to you. It will drive you crazy within 3 days. And you want to be like that forever. You know, no contact with anybody, because there is nobody else. Why do you want that? Why does any sane person want such a perfection? Even if he could have it. Therefore, Kapila Dev is talking sensible philosophy. He's presenting the Vaishnava understanding that desire is the natural condition of consciousness. Descartes said cogito ergo sum. He was trying to prove something logically. He wanted to throw away all the old philosophy, which was confused, and start from scratch. So he said, I won't assume anything. I won't believe anything just because it was said in the past. Let me just start from the beginning. How do I know that anything is true? How do I know that anything is real? Well, here I am questioning everything. It's me. I'm questioning. So I'm thinking I must exist. Maybe God doesn't exist, or maybe nobody else exists. Maybe it's only me. But at least I exist because I'm thinking. I'm doubting everything, so I'm thinking. Cogito ergo sum. I'm thinking, therefore I exist. What I am, I don't know. But at least I can say that. And whether anybody else exists, I don't know. But I'm thinking, therefore I exist. Well, we can say something similar to that. You're alive, therefore you have desire. You're a conscious being, therefore you cannot avoid being full of desires. And any program to attempt to become desireless, just like, and it's part of the program of becoming impersonal, merging, is to get rid of desires. Because if you have desires, you're going to have to find someone to fulfill those desires for you. You're going to have to look for relationships. If you're hungry, you've got to find some food. You're going to find a relationship between you and the food. You know, put it in your stomach. And probably you're going to have to deal with other people to acquire that food. You could probably have to kill something to eat it. Or at least approach a vegetable, a plant, and pull off its fruit. There has to be some relationship to fulfill any desire. So if you want to get rid of all relationships, you have to get rid of all desires. You have to, do you want to become impersonal? Emerge, you have to become desireless. Another impossibility. The conscious being is always full of one kind of desire or another. It's just what kind. It's way you're going to focus your desires. We have an urge to love and be loved, to share pleasure, to give pleasure and take pleasure. Pleasure is the motive, usually. Natural, only very sick people take pleasure out of pain. And people who are suffering and are covered by ignorance, they take pleasure in oblivion. You know, just become stoned out, drunk, oblivious. That's their pleasure. And then people who are even sicker than that, they get pleasure out of pain, feeling pain or causing pain to others. But the healthy state, normal state, is to enjoy pleasure, not pain, or not oblivion. So the natural urge of the soul is to enjoy and to give enjoyment to others. Loving exchange for the sharing of enjoyment. That's the natural desire of the soul. That should be revived. We should give up our sick mentality of getting our pleasure out of abusing other people, or out of dragging ourselves down into oblivious states of consciousness with various kinds of intoxications and addictions. And we stuff ourselves with food so that we can become oblivious. We feel pain, emotional pain, and we obliterate the pain by stuffing our stomach. Some people do that. Or we have to resort to stronger drugs, alcohol, intoxicants, in the search of oblivion. Or we're so agitated after and exhausted after coming home from work, we just turn on the television set and turn into a potato sitting on the couch. Another form of oblivion. That's the mode of ignorance. In the mode of passion, a person is pursuing sense gratification. If I get a tingling of gratification, you know, a jolt of pleasure, after struggling very hard to acquire it through passionate means, that will be my happiness. You know, sense gratification. I get a lot of money, a lot of power. I enjoy sex. I enjoy other kinds of sense gratification. That's rajasic. And then sattvic, also maya, just more refined maya. I have no concept, or I just deny that real happiness is in our true spiritual life, in relationship with God. I forget God. God's too much trouble, or he doesn't, you know, he's not real. I'll get my happiness out of art and music and literature, and altruistic works, philosophy. This is sattvic, mode of goodness. You're not hurting anybody, and you seem to be doing some sort of good, you know, but you're forgetting God again. You're forgetting your real business of your life. So it's another kind of illusion, but a sort of nice illusion, harmless illusion. But it's really all various forms of obliterating, at least covering over the real desires of the soul, and substituting perverted desires. Perverted desire is either in mode of goodness, mode of passion, or mode of ignorance, or a mixture of all three, or two of them. So we, as Kapila Devi is implying, he's not saying it explicitly, but he's implying by his statement that attachment is the cause of suffering, of ignorance and confusion, but it's also the same kind of attachment if you redirect it to the Lord's devotees, that becomes that opens up the doors of liberation for you. And Prabhupada draws the implication from that. It is purport. I haven't read the commentaries in Sanskrit, but I'm sure he gets it from Srila Jiva Goswami's and Vishnu Chakravarti's comments in Sanskrit, that this means that desire cannot be avoided it has to be properly channeled. We should want to satisfy the Supreme Lord, and we should understand the best way to do that is to satisfy the Lord's devotees. And that's the right course for fulfilling our own desires, our own ambitions, spiritual ambitions, real ambitions in life. Everybody has a propensity, as Prabhupada said in the purport, to be attached to something. We cannot avoid that. If we don't have an ordinary relationship, we form a relationship with a pet animal or some fantasy, some ism. It's not even a person, it doesn't even really exist. Some ideal, socialism, communism, you know, perfect society where everybody only takes what they need and gives everything they do freely. Everyone works very hard and is given whatever they need. Perfect socialism, communism. No money, no bosses, no, everyone's just cooperating. That's supposed to be a natural state of human society. But they tried it. It didn't happen. It didn't work. In their communist ideal society, at least a society, a socialist society that was supposed to be working toward communism, people were just as selfish as before. And what happened is people didn't feel motivated to work, because there was no profit to be made. You couldn't become successful in business because no one was supposed to make any profit. You know, everyone just works out of altruistic goals, but actually people weren't altruistic. They stopped working, or they worked as little as they could. So in the Soviet Union, Russia, there was a joke, a saying, that we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. That was the actual consciousness. It doesn't work. You know, some artificial, unrealistic idea of what is good, what will cause happiness. It doesn't. You can form your attachment to some completely impractical utopian idea of perfection. But because it's unreal and impractical, happiness cannot be gotten from it. Here's a practical program. The program of Krishna consciousness is not an impractical utopia. You know, you can think it is, you can deny it, but the devotees have experienced that the satisfaction of trying to serve Krishna, even making a feeble attempt to serve Krishna, the satisfaction is real. When you're situated as a devotee, even every neophyte can attest to this. As much as we are situated as devotees, we're feeling satisfied about it. We're getting actual happiness from it. Maybe it's not pure because we're not perfectly situated. We go through this condition called, the Vishnu Chakravarti calls Gona Tovala, thick and thin. It's one stage of the immature, weak faith of a beginner. But sometimes he feels enthusiastic, like a boy in school who thinks at first, you know, oh, I'm going to learn, you know, algebra, and I'm going to become expert. I'm going to become a great mathematician. I'll do it in a few weeks. And then he finds out that algebra isn't so easy. And he gets frustrated. You know, after a few lessons, he says, well, I can't understand this stuff. And then he wants to give it up the next week. And then the second week, he's back into his enthusiasm, back and forth, thick and thin. So a neophyte devotee may go through that phase. Sometimes he's feeling enthusiastic, and then, you know, a few hours later, or a few days later, he's feeling completely discouraged, unenthusiastic. It's a natural stage, but it's immature. We should be able to pass through that. Although we realize that we're not going to attain perfection overnight, we get great satisfaction from the slow progress that we are making. Gradual process of becoming closer and closer to Krishna, and actually earning Krishna's trust. If you have been given a responsibility in devotional service, consider yourself the most fortunate person in the world. You've got a relationship with God and with his devotees. You've been assigned to do such and such a service. Whether it's sweeping the floor, cleaning the latrines, it doesn't matter. It's a divine relationship with God. This is a dog's collar. but we should be very proud to be wearing it. We're called dasa, which means slave. But to be Krishna's dog or Krishna's slave is the most noble position, most honorable position. As far as we're concerned, we're happy and proud to be called dasa, and to let ourselves dress up like Krishna's dogs. Ohi Vaishnava Thakura Tomara Kukura. My old great Vaishnava, saintly Vaishnava, please consider that I'm your dog, and you can ask me to do anything, or if you just want to kick me, go ahead. You know, a dog is faithful. Dog has bad qualities. You know, he's dirty and uncontrolled, doesn't know when to stop eating. A dog, if you let him eat without restriction, if you don't stop him, he'll eat himself to death. A cat won't do that. A cat knows when to stop eating, but a dog doesn't. He's stupid. So a dog has bad qualities, but he has a good quality of faithfulness. When he has a master, he puts all his trust in the master. The master may kick him, may mistreat him, and he'll still not abandon the master. So Vaishnava should be like that in respect to his to Krishna and the devotees who are connecting him to Krishna. Not that we should tolerate any and all abuse, but we should have a general attitude of faithfulness. Not to get disgusted whenever everything isn't arranged for our perfect satisfaction. We have to be tolerant and faithful. That is the meaning of the term bona fide. Bona fide, acting in good faith. We may not act properly, but we're trying to act properly. We're doing everything as best we can in good faith. That is what we call bona fide. We don't talk about perfect guru. We don't see that terminology, although Satguru is there in the Shastra, the term is there. But Prabhupada, it wasn't his favorite way of referring to the guru. He doesn't talk about perfect guru. He talks about bona fide guru, faithful guru. That's a guru, someone who's perfectly faithful to his guru, and ultimately to Krishna, and to all his predecessors, to the Sampradaya, faithful. Would never intentionally misrepresent them or go against their desire. Despite my imperfection, I'm not going to intentionally betray the confidence that my guru has placed in me. He's given me service and he's trusting me with it. I will do my best to fulfill my responsibilities and satisfy him. That's being in good faith, acting in good faith. So, Prabhupada, we're talking about sadhus here. Prabhupada talks about what Krishna says. Apichet sudaracharo bhajate mama nanyava sarariva samantavya samyak vyavasito hi saha. At the end of the... Oh, what chapter is that? Chapter 9 in the Gita. Even if someone behaves very bad, he breaks... Prabhupada says, even if a devotee doesn't follow the regulative principles properly, that's a serious thing. We take a vow to follow four regulative principles. Avoid meat eating, illicit sex, intoxication. Even if a devotee fails to follow all those principles, he's still a sadhu. Krishna says, even if he's horrible in his behavior, wicked, su duracharo. Duracharo means behaving bad. And su duracharo means behaving very bad. And it's not just once or twice, but a pattern, habitual, bad behavior. You know, you don't call someone sudurcharo when he makes one or two mistakes. It's when he's constantly doing wrong things. Then he's called sudurachara, wicked. Now, you're not wicked for making one mistake, but you're wicked when you let it become a habit. But Krishna accepts that, still a devotee. If he doesn't give up considering me his Lord, and doesn't give up trying to still dedicate everything to me, despite the fact that I'm so fallen because of my wicked behavior and my failing to fulfill the promises I made to my guru, that I'd follow these principles, I've broken my vows, but still I have no choice but to try to continue serving Krishna. I may go to hell for my offenses, let me go to hell, I still will try to serve Krishna and my spiritual master. So if that's the condition, it's not a fortunate condition, we should never want to be in such a condition. But Krishna says, even if that's the condition of the devotee, I still consider him a sadhu, a saintly person. Samyagvyavasitosaha. He's fixed his mind properly. He's got the right determination. Kshipram bhavati dharmatma. He will very quickly rectify himself and give up his nonsense if he remains determined to be my devotee. If he doesn't give up that determination, all of his evil behavior will be rectified soon enough. And then Shashwat Chanti Nigachati, then he will attain perfect and eternal peace. He'll get free of his anxiety and be happy and satisfied. Konteya Pratijanihi Name Bhakta Pranashati. Konteya, you can tell everybody else. Announce it to everybody. And I want you to be the example. My devotee never perishes. If he's my devotee, no matter what he does, I'll protect him. So Krishna says, even an evil, a devotee who does all sorts of nonsense, Krishna still considers him a devotee. But he doesn't say, he says, sadar eva samantavya. He doesn't say, gurur eva samantavya, that he should be considered a guru. He can be accepted as some sort of devotee, but a guru should be in a better condition than that. A guru should be honest and faithful. A devotee whose faith is weak and whose behavior is bad, he's still a devotee, but you cannot accept him as a spiritual authority. You cannot take him as your guru. He's to be pitied and helped. He's a sick person. You don't go to get cured from a sick person. But still, we respect. We don't disrespect anybody who has any attachment to Krishna. It was asked me just an hour ago, was Kamsa a Vaishnava? No. Kamsa was an out-and-out demon. He was always thinking about Krishna, but he was always thinking of Krishna in a hateful way. That's not devotion. That's not love. And he may have done some puja of Narayana sometime in his life, but that's not devotion. While he was, you know, waving a stick of incense at Narayana, he was thinking about how he hated Krishna. So that cancels out whatever puja he did. But he was constantly thinking of Krishna with a hateful way, a hateful attitude. So that's not a devotee. But one who remains attached to the Lord and understands that my life should be dedicated to Krishna's pleasure, even though I'm making a total mess of trying to do that. I'm doing all the wrong things. But I understand I should be satisfying Krishna. I should do what he wants and not do what he doesn't want. Even though I'm doing all the things he doesn't want and failing to do the thing he wants. But I know at least what I'm supposed to do. Then you're accepted as a devotee. Maybe a fallen devotee, a devotee in serious trouble, but still a devotee. Therefore, even though we may have so many material attachments, and some of them may be evil attachments, sinful attachments, we may be attached to doing bad things that are unacceptable in the eyes of God. There's no way that illicit sex, killing unnecessarily creatures just to stuff your stomach, that these can please Krishna. No way, ever. If you're doing them, you're displeasing Krishna. But if you're trying to become his devotee despite all attachments, and the best way that Kapila Deva recommends to try to do that, take your attachments and redirect them to Krishna's devotees. So eva sadhushu krito, the same kind of attachment, if directed to the devotees of the saintly devotees of the Lord, that will open up the door of liberation. Because by staying in the association of devotees, you will always be Krishna conscious. You can't help it. Devotees are thinking about Krishna, and they're much of the time talking about Krishna. Maybe neophyte devotees don't always talk about Krishna, and they don't always think about Krishna, if they're immature. Prajalta is there, material thoughts are there. So you may not get much inspiration from the association of neophyte devotees, but you still get some. Satam prasangam mamabhirya sambhido. In the association of devotees of the Lord, one gets the benefit of hearing the Lord's glories. Even if you're with very immature devotees, if you stay with them long enough, eventually they'll speak something about Krishna's glories. Eventually, in between all the prajalpa and the fault finding, they'll say something to glorify. Otherwise they're not devotees at all. But they can't think of anything to glorify Krishna. They never feel inspired to glorify Krishna. What kind of devotees are there? But they never say Hari Bol. They never want to chant Krishna's names. They don't like kirtans. They don't like prasadam. If you hate prasadam and hate kirtans and hate the association of devotees, forget it. You're not a devotee. To be a devotee means to be attracted, being with other devotees, attracted to hearing and chanting Krishna's name, attracted to Krishna's prasadam. If you refuse to touch prasadam because, oh, they put sugar in it, you know, white sugar, they use white sugar, white flour in their halava, and I don't touch these things, I'm in the mode of goodness, and you refuse prasadam because of that, then you're faithless. Yeah. I will risk my life and take the white sugar and the white flour because it's Krishna's halava prasadam, and I'll accept this. Maybe a little bit. Maybe not too much. So if we're attached to devotees and attached to all the things about devotional service, the practices and the paraphernalia of devotional service, the tulsi leaves, the smell of the incense, the darshan of the deities, the sound of the kirtan, the places, the holy places where the devotees assemble and where Krishna has performed his eternal pastimes, if we're attached to those things and to the devotees themselves, then we'll be securely situated in transcendence. The door to liberation will be wide open. We don't have to sit there waiting for it to open. The yogis and the gyanis are sitting in front of a locked door, and they may have to wait many lifetimes before someone comes with the key to open it up for them. But the devotees, for them, the door is wide open. They can march through anytime they want. Liberation, mukti, what is, who is it? Oh. Not Bilba Mangala. I guess King Kulashekha says, mukti svayam, mukhavitan jali sevite sman. For a pure devotee of Lord Narayan, liberation, goddess Devi, goddess of liberation, is standing in front of him with folded palms. You know, with the, you know, folded palms, begging, what can I do for you? Like a maidservant, waiting for an order. Mm-hmm. She's ready to do anything, offering herself as a servant. So the devotees have liberation begging them to please accept, for them to please accept her service. That's how easy. The door to liberation is wide open for the pure devotees. For those who are attached to the association of Krishna and his devotees and everything about devotional service. Sounds like same kind of Krishna consciousness that we've been taught. Even though this is being spoken millions of years ago, it seems like the principles of Krishna consciousness haven't changed in these several million years. Basic principles are the same. Okay, so I'll stop there. Anybody have any questions or any comments?
Can you elaborate again that states of sickness, you were describing different status of sickness, one who is trying to seek refuge in harming others, one who is seeking refuge.
Well, this is in deeper and deeper modes of nature.
Mm.
In the mode of goodness, you're just trying to find some innocent pursuit, some distraction. Art, music, philosophy. It doesn't hurt anybody. And it seems to do some sort of good. It elevates your consciousness. It may even do some good for mankind, to increase our store of knowledge in our treasure house of works of art. Whatever. Pursuits and distractions in the mode of goodness seem to be good. But they have no spiritual value.
in and of themselves. I mean, someone can dovetail. You can make great art to glorify God, too. And at certain times in history, most art was done to glorify God. But in materialistic civilization, we just have art and philosophy without God. It's in the world of goodness, but it's completely material. So that's okay, but there's nothing spiritual about it. And then in the mode of passion, you're pursuing selfish gratification, either immediate sense gratification or something extended like some political aim, try to benefit your country or your community. And you're working very hard and vigorously to achieve that goal. And you probably have to push someone else out of the way. You have to defeat someone else. And that's the mode of passion. You have to fight to get what you need or want. So that's pursuits in the mode of passion. And it usually involves suffering. It's hard to struggle, and usually you have to cause some pain and deprive somebody else of to get it for yourself, whatever it is. You've got to take it away from somebody else. So you usually have to cause pain to others to become happy in the mode of passion. And in the mode of ignorance, you're just pursuing, either you're not doing anything, you're just lazy, or you're actively trying to obliterate your consciousness. Just become intoxicated, or go to sleep, mesmerized by something. These are all attempts to find happiness in the wrong way, in these three modes. Matirna Krishne Paratapsvatova. All these different kinds of people in the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance, they're not focusing their attention on Krishna. They're not thinking about Krishna. They're not interested in Krishna, in God. Neither are they motivated by themselves, or does anybody else motivate them to be interested in God. Therefore, they're just falling into various kinds of illusion. And they cannot find actual happiness. I don't know if that's the right kind of elaboration you wanted. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. All right. Something else? Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. You said that happiness in more of goodness, better. So even devotees also sometimes, becoming a devotee also, you also sometimes try to get some happiness. Like more of passion,
but that means material happiness. That means we're keeping up our old habits. We're mixed.
Okay.
We know that real happiness is spiritual, though we're still in the old habit of looking for material happiness. And usually it's whatever we were doing before. If we were before in the mode of ignorance, we slip back into ignorance. If before we were in goodness, we slip back into that, into whatever was our old pattern of thought and behavior. And until we become fully convinced that real happiness is found on the spiritual platform, not the material, then we'll continue to be slipping back into our old habits, periodically, or maybe constantly. It's because of weakness of conviction. We're not really convinced that by simply serving Krishna, everything we want and everything we need will be provided. We're not fully convinced of that. That's the cause of that problem. So we shift gears back into our old material habits. We know not to go out and break the principle grossly, but we talk some prajalpa, we listen to something on the radio, maybe sneak in and watching a movie, this or that. Sense gratification. We know that it's a waste, but we still indulge in it sometimes. That's bad habit from the past. And we do it because our faith is not strong enough, our conviction is, we're not fully convinced that this process does work and does fulfill all our desires. Okay? It's also the reason for anxiety. If your problem is anxiety, same cause. You're not fully convinced that Krishna is in control, and you think things are out of control, therefore you're in anxiety. Anxiety means you think things are out of control. That means you forget, or you fail to realize, or you're not willing to be convinced that Krishna is absolutely in control of everything. If you were, then you'd have no reason for anxiety. You would have no anxiety. So some devotees, that's their problem. Some devotees, their problem is they slip back into sense gratification now and then. They're sloppy in their devotional service.
Other devotees may be strict, but they're very often in anxiety, worried, and thinking too much about what they're doing wrong. But that anxiety means also not being convinced that Krishna is totally in control, and that he's protecting his devotees. Okay? Same problem, just different symptoms.
You said about anxiety, like we are doing some services and at that time we have anxiety that whether I'll be able to do this particular service properly or not. Mm-hmm. So that is,
well, it depends. A certain kind of anxiety is appropriate. You can't just say, well, you know, I just try to do something for Krishna and it's Krishna's responsibility to see that it comes out right. Then you become lazy. So you should have transcendental anxiety. You know, I'm trying to do something for Krishna and it's hard to do, I have to try to do it right. And I have to pay attention to all the pitfalls and avoid them. And get everything right the best I can. That means to be worried about it. But it's a transcendental anxiety then. If you're worried about satisfying Krishna, that's spiritual anxiety. That's perfectly appropriate. If you're worried about your own failure, that's material. Now, failure or success doesn't matter. What matters is simply that I try to satisfy Krishna. And I can be in anxiety about that, that Krishna will be happy. The gopis are always in anxiety that Krishna will be happy. His parents are always in anxiety. His friends are always in anxiety. And they're accepted as the best devotees. You want to be free from anxiety, don't take birth in Vrindavan. You know, Krishna is every day being attacked by some rakshasa, sent by Kamsa. Lots of anxiety in Vrindavan. You know, one day, Kali has poisoned the lake and all the boys die and all their cows. And Krishna himself is caught in the coils of the snake and he's about to be strangled. You don't think that's a cause of anxiety? Plenty of anxiety. If you don't want that, then don't take birth in Vrindavan. But that's transcendental anxiety. That's the basis of a transcendental bliss. It's not what we think is anxiety, it's something completely different. Okay?
Yes,
please.
Could we attach towards devotees, an association? So, I mean, when we attach, so we attach to some devotees and not to others. That is in the mode of passion, ignorance or goodness.
It's human. It's hard to make friends with everybody. Because we have different natures. Sometimes the chemistry doesn't match. Or you may have some conflict with somebody. Somebody may have done something bad to you in the past, and you can't completely forgive them yet. That's human. It's not perfect, but it's human. So, in practice, we can't always make friends with all the devotees. We should make some special friends. You know, we should be friendly with all the devotees. We should have no bad feelings against any of the devotees. But we may only make very close friendships with a few devotees. That's normal and acceptable. You know, you should have a basically friendly attitude to all the devotees. You should never consider any devotee your enemy. Even if you have a reason to, put that reason aside and forgive him, because he's a Vaishnava. Forgive him. Even a devotee who has done a horrible thing to you, you should forgive him because he's a devotee. And still think him, he's my friend theoretically, but I can't go near him. Okay, don't go near him. But give him respect from a distance. And then some other devotees, maybe only a few, you can have an intimate relationship with. That's natural. Then when we all graduate from the material world and we're together in Vaikuntha, then there won't be such problems. And everybody can, you know, without restriction, be friends. Because nobody's abusing anybody else in Vaikuntha, in the spiritual world. But in the material world, they do, you know, unintentionally, devotees are fighting. Two great devotees. Prataparudra was an eternal associate of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Krishnadev Rai, the king of Vijayanagar, was a great devotee in the Madhva Sampradaya. He was a disciple of Vyaskirtan, Krishnadev Rai. Also a devotee of Krishna. Different Sampradaya, but they were both great devotees of Krishna. And they fought a war, a big war, against each other. Prataparudra and Krishnadev Rai. Big fight. Thousands of men were killed. You know, bloody battle. Several battles. And finally they resolved it. And Krishnadev Rai married one of the daughters of Prataparudra, and it was, and they were friends after that. But sometimes devotees fight. And maybe Krishna's pastime, or it may just be
the funny circumstances of material life. Things happen in the material world. Even devotees come into conflict. So we have to tolerate that. And if a devotee mistreats you, you should try to forgive him. Because he's a devotee of Krishna. Okay. Something else? Yes.
You said that service materialist that leads service to materialists that leads towards darkness.
Service
to materialists.
Attachment, I think is what the term was used. I don't know if I said service. Well, you serve someone because you become attached to them anyway, the same thing. They're related. And okay, so yes, that's the Prabhupada says pretty much that, that attachment, in the purport Prabhupada says attachment to, the verse says attachment, not the verse, the verse quoted from Rishabdev in the fifth canto, the Prabhupada quotes in the purport, attachment to people who are too much associated, attached to the association of the opposite sex, that is the door to hell, the gateway to hell. Yeah, okay, so, and then the question is?
My question was that, suppose the person is working for a company, and the person is the boss, he is definitely materialist, but not to earn money.
Yes.
His only purpose is making profit out of it.
Yes.
So, if we are serving in a company, then actually we are serving a materialist, and then we are leading towards darkness.
No, no, see, service, I don't think service and attachment are necessarily always the same thing. You can be obliged to serve somebody, because you have to work a job, and there aren't too many good employers around, saintly employers. Most of them are bastards. Yeah. So you have to accept employment from wherever you can, and you may have a lousy boss, and you have to tolerate him. Either that or go find a different job if you can. Yeah. You may be in a situation where you can't do that. Rupa and Sanatana Goswami were coerced, threatened that their family would be, violence would be done to their family if they didn't serve Nawab Dasen Shah, become his ministers. They had to do it, they were forced. So they were serving a horrible master who threatened to, cause it to do violence to their family. They were not attached to him. Lord Chaitanya delivered them. He didn't blame them for having worked for the Muslim government. All the other Brahmins, the Brahmin community, ostracized Rupa and Sanatana, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't. He recognized them as Goswamis and gave them Vrindavan Dham. Here, this is your place, you take charge of it. Yeah? You re-establish it, you write the Shastras. So he appointed Rupa and Sanatana to be the Acharyas and to be the Mahants, the in-charge of Vrindavan Dham. He recognized them, even though they were working for the Muslim government. He didn't care who their boss was. That their boss was Nara Vishen Shah. He ignored that. It made no difference to Lord Chaitanya. So Krishna is not going to care that we work for some bastard in some company. Krishna doesn't care. As long as we're not attached to it. Rupa and Sanatana didn't serve Nara Vishen Shah out of love for his government. They had to, so they did it. And they weren't blamed for it. Not by Lord Chaitanya. Okay? And if you can find, if you can work with devotees, that's better. Hopefully a devotee employer is not going to be so bad. Hopefully. That's the best thing if you can arrange that. Or a Vaishnava Brahmana, better he's self-employed and doesn't have to be anybody else's paid servant. Then he's autonomous. And he doesn't have to take abuse from anybody. That's also a better position. But sometimes we can't, find that ideal situation. We have to tolerate something less than ideal. Okay. Hare Krishna. Yes.
A doctor in Vedic civilization is considered a Brahmana or Vaishya?
In Vedic civilization he's considered a Brahmana. But in Bengal, after the rule of King Balal Sen, I don't remember when he lived, 7th century, 3rd century, Balal Sen, he rewrote the Dharma Shastras. He made up his own rules. Balal Sen, very famous king. He said, the only Brahmins belong to 5 families. The Chattopadhyayas, the Vandopadhyayas, the Mukherjees, the Chatterjees, the Banerjees, and the 2 other families. Everybody else is a Shudra. These are the Brahmins. There are no, and all the other Brahmins are no longer Brahmins, and any other occupation except for belonging to one of these five families, everybody else is a shudra. Including the vaidyas and the everybody else, you know, the doctors and everybody else, they're all shudras. But because of the Balal Sen, you know, with his independent idea, concoction. But in the original Vedic system, a doctor is a Brahmin. An astrologer is a Brahmin. These are Brahminical sciences, Brahminical arts. Okay?
Advaita philosophy people are devotees or non-devotees?
They're non-devotees. Krishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu considers them the worst offenders. There are two classes of impersonalists. There are innocent impersonalists and there are demon impersonalists. So if someone doesn't understand, just can't catch the idea that God is really a person, he just is innocent, naive. And if you could explain it to him properly, he would accept it. Then he's not envious. So he's just an innocent impersonalist, naive impersonalist. But someone who understands better than that, and just hates letting God be a person, then he's worse than those great demons who Krishna killed in his various avatars. They're the worst demons. Because they're trying to obliterate Krishna philosophically. They can't obliterate Krishna. They can't stand up to Krishna in battle. Hiranyakashipu couldn't. Hiranyaksha couldn't. Ravana couldn't. They couldn't, you know, defeat Krishna in battle. So now they try to stab him in the back with philosophy. Garyal, the Absolute is so great. You're so great, O Supreme. But you have no face, no personality. They're just trying to stab him in the back. Obliterate him philosophically. So that's the worst kind of demoniac attack. It's cheating. At least a real demon will stand up fair and fight face to face on the battlefield. But the impersonalists, the demonic impersonalists, they sometimes pretend to be devotees. Very often they pretend to be devotees. Jai Jagadisha Hare. So they're stabbing Hare, Jai Jagadisha Hare in the back at the same time. So that's treachery. You know, it's dishonest. Therefore, it's worse than being a regular demon. Okay. Okay, yes,
many times you use the word Mayavadi and impersonalist interchangeably.
Yes, because nowadays almost everybody's a Mayavadi. There's very few anybody else who isn't a Mayavadi. There may be such a thing, a theoretical category of an innocent, naive impersonalist. But practically, Mayavad is so pervasive. And almost anybody who pretends to be anything spiritual is a Mayavadi. Almost everybody. Go down the highway, the boulevards in Delhi, and look at all the boardings for this kata and that kata. They're all Mayavadis, except for our ISKCON advertisements. But practically everybody else. Okay, there's some Vaishnavas there also, but practically all of them are Mayavadis.
So technically, there's a difference between the Mayavadi and the impersonalists.
Nowadays, practically, there isn't any. You know, because they're all infected. Everybody's so infected with Mayavad philosophy. It's, you know, endemic. Like, everyone's infected with it. You know, if 98% of the population has AIDS, what's the distinction between AIDS and any other disease? Everyone's got AIDS. You know? So everyone's infected with Mayavad philosophy. They're all Mayavadis, de facto. Maybe theoretically there's another category, but practically everyone's infected with Mayavad. Yes.
In the previous Vedas, there seem to be adhis, as mentioned in Bhagavatam, but there are no Mayavadis or impersonalists.
Where?
Or the advent of Shankaracharya.
Sure, plenty. There always are. Shankara was a very effective promoter of Advaitavad. He was not the first. He was just one of the most successful. And he eclipsed almost everybody who went before him. But before him was Lord Buddha. And the Buddhist the Advaitavad philosophy of Shankara is basically the same philosophy as taught by Lord Buddha. So at least the Buddhists were active in Mayavadis before the Mayavadis. And you can see, we have books written before Shankara that are same Mayavad philosophy. He didn't make it up, he just was the most effective promoter of it.
Prior to Buddha?
Yeah, ancient scriptures. You got the Yoga, Yoga Vishishtha Ramayana, taught, spoken millions of years ago. You have the teachings of Dattatreya, incarnation of God. Also Mayavada philosophy. You know, we got Mayavada philosophy going back millions of years. We still have the books. The books are still there. Okay. I just smashed the Mayavadi tonight, but it's fine. Yeah. Oh, I didn't. I joined ISKCON a little late in 1973. There were over 5,000 disciples, and I didn't get much chance to be with Prabhupada in person. Very little. I had about 10 minutes direct association face to face with Prabhupada. I only was able to be there, you know, in the same place where Prabhupada was visiting. I was able to hear Prabhupada give Bhagavatam class maybe 200 times. You know, but then I could tell you about the personal experiences. Yeah, I can summarize them in a few minutes, and not much of it. Other devotees who joined before me, or even some who joined when I did, they got much more association. My association was mostly with Prabhupada's BBT. You know, serving Prabhupada, his vani, his words, and his books, working on his books. That was my association mostly. I mean, I could tell some episodes, there were a few of them, but they were just, you know, incidental things.
I remember the...
Prabhupada came to Honolulu in 1976. It's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, so it's not an easy place to, you know, you can't just drive there, you have to fly in an airplane to get to Hawaii. Even to go from one island to the other, you have to fly in an airplane usually. It's the shortest flights in the world. You know, a flight from Honolulu to Oahu is 12 or 15 minutes. Very, very, but still you have to fly in an airplane. So when Prabhupada came there, many of the senior devotees from the west coast of the United States came to see Prabhupada in Hawaii, because he was coming from India, and then coming, you know, maybe he went to Japan, Hong Kong, and then he went to Hawaii. So the American devotees hadn't seen him for some time, so some of the leaders, Rameshwar Maharaj, several other sannyasis, they came to Hawaii, but they didn't stay more than a few days. They went back to their services after a few days. Then Prabhupada was there, only with the local devotees, maybe 40 devotees who lived in the Honolulu temple, and only a few outsiders. So after that, after the first 3 days when all the sannyasis left, it was possible to actually be with Prabhupada. You know, almost everyone went on the morning walks. You could get an opportunity to fan Prabhupada, put the chandan on his forehead. Hari Shari, who was Prabhupada's secretary, he one morning let me put the chandan on Prabhupada's forehead during the Guru Puja. But he warned me, don't get it in his eyes. Make sure it doesn't drip. So when devotees, when they prepare the chandan, they shouldn't make it too liquid. It's not supposed to let it get in Prabhupada's eyes. And so therefore it should be semi-solid. And you should be careful applying it. The temple president, not the president, the temple commander, didn't like me. So he arranged that although everybody was going on the morning walk, he told me I had to work in the kitchen at that time in the morning, just so I wouldn't be allowed to go on Prabhupada's morning walk. I may have already told this story. My assignment was to cut up some food for Prabhupada. Did I tell about that? I did.
First time when we went to Govardhan.
Should I tell it again? Because I didn't hear it. I mean, I only know there's only a few experiences like that, minor things. I wasn't allowed to go. This is my, you know, retribution for being on the wrong side of this devotee, that I was not allowed to be with Prabhupada on his morning walk. But I was in the kitchen cutting up fruit for Prabhupada. Every morning, the same banana, pineapple, apple. I was instructed, take the apple and soak it in water after you cut it so it doesn't turn brown. And put salt on the ananas, because Prabhupada, you know, liked it like that so that the acid wouldn't have too much effect. It cuts down on the acid when you put salt on the pineapple. And I was supposed to, after cutting it up, stand outside at the end of the Bhagavatam class, when Prabhupada would leave and go back to his room, stand at the door of the temple room with that plate and offer it to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada every day would pick one piece of fruit, take it and go on, move on, you know, up to his room. And he always took a piece of banana every day. One day he took his piece of banana and he had walked past me and he was on the way to the staircase with his back toward me and should not have been able to see what was happening behind him. And immediately, three sannyasis, there were still a few sannyasis, came on my right side and demanded Mahaprasadam. And about five children on the left side also demanded Mahaprasadam. And I was in doubt who should get the prasadam first. I didn't do anything for a minute. You know, I didn't know what to do. All of a sudden I felt a hand on, or a cane on my shoulder. It was Prabhupada. He had turned around. I don't know how he saw what was happening, but he turned around and tapped me on the shoulder. And he didn't say anything, but he pointed to the children. Yeah,
okay.
To this cane. Just, that was it. Wordless, but he instructed me that the children should get the prasadam first, even before the sannyasis. Little thing like that. Okay, not earth-shattering, no big instruction. Prabhupada, and then even more devotees left. And Prabhupada would have lunch every day at 2:30. A devotee called Upendra was cooking for Prabhupada. Prabhupada liked his cooking. Old devotee. But Prabhupada didn't like to eat the dal, the outer shell of the dal. He would leave the beans in the dal. He'd drink the liquid, but not take the beans. He told his servant once, you can eat the wrappers if you want, I shan't. Yeah. He didn't like to eat the outside of the dal. So every day, Prabhupada would be done with his lunch and the plate would come downstairs. And there was nobody in the temple. Actually, everybody had been sent on sankirtan. And I was one of the few devotees who didn't go out. I had some excuse. I was working for the BBT. So they would take Prabhupada's plate with the remnants and put it in the refrigerator outside the kitchen, you know, in the devotee prasadam hall. And I would go, you know, at 2:45, open the refrigerator, and I would always take their cup of dal. Nobody would, you know, nobody was around to take the Mahaprasadam. And I would say I'm still in ISKCON because I took those remnants for 2 weeks. Yeah. Anyway, little episode. Okay, we can stop now? Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.